Good afternoon and welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. My name is Paul Howard, and I'm a senior fellow and a director at the Manhattan Institute's Center for Medical Progress. Our guest today is Derek Lowe, a PhD in organic chemistry who has worked for several major pharmaceutical companies since 1989 on drug discovery projects against schizophrenia, Alzheimer's, diabetes, osteoporosis, and other diseases. He blogs regularly at In the Pipeline, one of, if not the best, web blog analyzing the perils of drug development from inside the belly of Big Pharma. Derek, thanks for joining us on today's Innovative Ideas podcast.
Glad to be here.
Derek, one of the, I guess, the biggest questions surrounding the industry right now, broadly speaking, is where's the innovation? Much like the Wendy's conversation a couple decades ago, where's the beef? At least in terms of new products reaching market, and judging by the share prices of many large pharma companies, investors don't seem to have much confidence that the pipelines are going to be able to sustain the current business model, which I think you've written about quite a bit over at your blog. At least at the current rates of productivity and given a number of very significant product expirations, patent expirations that are going to be coming in the next few years, including Lipitor, the world's best-selling drug, which goes off patent next year.
Right.
So one of your recent blog posts really caught my attention because it seemed to be one of those times where things got right enough or went right enough to really catch your attention and suggest that maybe things aren't quite as bleak as we might think they are on the innovation front. Or maybe they're still bleak, but at least it's worth thinking about what might have gone right in this case. And you talked about, at length, a very small study where, in a nutshell, researchers had used genetically engineered immune system cells called T cells to attack a type of leukemia called chronic lymphocytic leukemia, if I've got that right, CLL.
Right. Chronic lymphoid leukemia, right.
Right. And it was wildly successful. So just for a moment, could you talk about this study? And again, this was a very small study, just with three patients. What made it stand out to you?
Well, what made it stand out was a couple of things. People have been, of course, trying to enlist the immune system for cancer therapy for some years now, with really mixed success. You know, there have been a few things out there, but it hasn't been as dramatic as people hope, because the immune system is, of course, capable of a tremendous amount of activity, sometimes misdirected. But people knew that if you could actually get the immune system to recognize particular cancer cells, it could go in and kill them. There's no doubt about it. Of course, the downside is that working with the immune system, the way I put it is, it's a bit like the medieval black magicians had to think about working with demons. You don't call up anything that you don't know how to send right back down.
Right, right. So because, of course, a hyperactive immune system is the cause of many serious and potentially fatal autoimmune diseases. So
you're
playing with fire.
Absolutely. And that's why, of course, those of us who do biomedical research just roll our eyes when we see various, you know, infomercials selling all sorts of stuff that's supposed to boost your immune system. In many cases, that's the last thing you want.
Right, right.
But with cancer, that is something you want as long as it's targeted. And people had been trying to do this, but this study actually may have turned a corner. It's very similar to some work that had been done in the past. They're trying to get these T cells to express a new receptor which will recognize only the cancerous cells and kill them. And the problem is people had tried to do this. They'd taken the T cells out, engineered them, put them back in, and they sort of disappeared. They just kind of did a little bit and evaporated and were gone fairly quickly. But this new study tried two or three methods at once to increase the activity of the T cells, to encourage them to divide, to boost their viability. And these were things that had been seen individually in preclinical studies. So they said, all right, let's try them. And they put these all together, and the combination seems to have worked. In fact, as you said, it probably worked even more than they expected. The good side of that, of course, is that it really seems to have dramatically helped some of the patients in the study who were, frankly, very near death. On the other hand, if this had gone the other way, if they had cranked up things a little bit more or infused a larger volume of cells, it could well have killed the patients.
Right, and set the whole field back again.
It could have, right. So this was again, being lucky in a way. They were good, but they were also lucky. So now that we know that this works like this, people can step in cautiously and say, okay, we really have something here. Let's wave this magic wand around without quite so much vigor in the arm motion. right. See what we get.
So really an innovation here, they took an idea that had worked well before. They added a wrinkle that allowed the cells to replicate once they were injected back into the patients.
Exactly.
And that appears to have produced a robust immune response. And in two out of the three patients who were treated, they were unable to find any evidence of the cancer cells after several weeks of,
right.
of treatment.
And this appears to continue. You don't often want to use the C word, cure, when you're talking about the C word, cancer, but these people would appear to have been cured. The third patient was not quite to that standard, but it still was a very dramatic result, and they are still alive, and these new T cells are still in there fighting.
Right, and at least I read on your site, you said that even the third patient, although you could still detect the cells, the patient was asymptomatic.
Exactly. So in that case, it's fought the cancer to at least a draw and probably is slowly winning.
Right.
And in the others, it was a very dramatic reversal. In fact, so dramatic that it came close to killing the patients. It put them both into the hospital because of the gigantic immune response.
Because, and this was, I thought was really astonishing, that there was kidney damage, but from some perspective, that was a good thing because it showed that the kidneys were actually being overwhelmed by the cellular debris from the B cells killing cancer tumors.
Exactly. It was killing off these leukemia cells so rapidly that the kidneys just couldn't clear this stuff out fast enough.
Right. Derek, from one perspective, I think you said earlier, like this was, and you said on your blog, this was exactly the kind of place you want to try something like this. It's potentially a dangerous approach to try and, to borrow an expression, take the brakes off the immune system. But you have patients who are treatment resistant, really no other good options.
They have run out of all the other reasonable options.
So if you're going to try something like this is exactly the right population to try it in.
Right.
And a couple of the comments on your blog I saw said, well, this was a trial of only three people, and I'm very skeptical. I think some of that skepticism is warranted. But on the other hand, given the course of the disease at this point within these patients, it's still a pretty remarkable achievement, even though it's only three patients.
It is. And they're right that, an N of three is not very big. But considering the background of this, that you could very, very reliably expect all of these people to be dead within weeks or months at the outside, that this N of three is about the most significant three-patient trial you could possibly imagine.
Right.
I mean, think back to the original discovery of antibiotics. When things like penicillin first became available, there were plenty of bacterial infections that doctors recognized, and they knew the course of these things as septicemia set in, and they could look at patients and say, this person is going to die.
Right.
And, 999,000 times out of a million, they were correct. This patient was going to die of rampant bacterial infection. When they gave the first patient penicillin, their fever broke, and within a few hours, they're asking if there's anything around to eat.
Right.
Now, that was an N of one, but that was an extremely significant N of one, and it was truly the harbinger of something real, and I think this is too.
And then actually, if the case is the same one, I remember after they ran out of penicillin, the patient had a relapse and died.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So in those cases, at least, if you're trying to compare, the effects of one statin drug versus another statin drug where you're looking for a difference of, 10 or 15 or 20% between patients, then you really need to rely on large statistical comparisons to try and eke out those small differences. But in the case we're looking at here, when the natural history or course of the disease at this point is death and very rapid death left untreated, you can have some confidence, especially when you see an enormous result like this, not a small improvement, but
exactly.
A remarkable
improvement.
Exactly,
and this was not an idiosyncratic result. This happened exactly the way that you would expect this to happen if it worked. You saw a tremendous proliferation of these T cells. You saw a tremendous amount of cellular debris from the targeted cells, and the targeted cells, and only those targeted cells, disappeared.
Right.
So all the parts are lined up in the correct order for this to be real.
The hypothesis of what you'd see was played out exactly as you thought it would be.
Right. Oh, I can tell you, the people who did this study were and will be beside themselves for quite a while.
This is, I think you put it on your website, it's like a once in a career, if that, type of outcome.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is the sort of thing you dream about as a scientist. But, of course, the next thing is try it again. Try it on some other things. There's a famous story about Jonas Salk. When they first got a hint that they had a polio vaccine that was working, they had all these tubes of red blood cells, and the polio would kill them off and turn the tubes straw yellow.
Mm.
But if there was a protective effect, they would remain red. So they had rack after rack after rack, week after week, turning yellow. They came in one day, and there was a row of them that were red.
Mm.
And it turned out all to be from the same vaccine type.
Right.
So everyone in the lab is running around whooping and yelling, and Salk comes in and says, "My gosh, what is it?" And they show him. And he, you know, shakes everyone's hand and everything. And then he says, "Calm down, people. Now let's see if we can do it again."
That's right.
Every scientist I've told that story to nods and says, "Good for him."
Right.
That's what these folks are going to be doing now.
And I noticed a blog post, which we'll link to on our site as well, that you wrote just today, talking about reproducibility in the literature and how few of the targets that are mentioned in the literature actually turn out to be reproducible in the labs, which is a depressing number of failed targets.
Yeah, and that's true. And this is the sort of thing that people, it's sort of depressing common knowledge in the industry that a lot of the really wild, hot, neat results that have just appeared in the high-profile journals are not necessarily going to play out the way they look.
Right. If it did, stock prices would be a lot higher right now.
We'd have a lot more drugs on the market.
But do you think, I had emailed this question to you, do you think the field of, I don't know what you call it, immunogenics, or what's the term of art to refer to this?
Well, yeah, I guess targeted immunology, right. Maybe, I don't know.
That targeted immunology has turned a corner. I know that Provenge came on the market, I guess a little over a year ago now or something to that effect. Relatively modest gains in survival,
right,
for prostate cancer patients. However, having said that, it's the only product for metastatic prostate cancer that has shown a survival benefit in that population, but still a very small one. But now Pfizer has a drug out called Yervoy, which is another immune-boosting treatment that appears to have very significant effects in metastatic melanoma treatment, which is a very difficult cancer to treat. So that's pretty impressive. And now we're seeing this. Do you think we're turning a little bit of a corner?
I hope so. I really hope so. It's a little early to say, but I think we may be. I mean, immunology is a ridiculously complex subject, and we're going to have some reversals. Some of these things stimulated by these good results are going to backfire spectacularly. I mean, I can just go ahead and kind of predict that right now. This one almost did.
Right.
But I think maybe we have.
Right.
This approach that was used in this CLL trial can potentially be used to attack a number of other different cancers. And believe me, that's exactly what people are going to try.
Right. Provided you can find a tumor protein expression that you can attack, you can use this approach.
And the neat thing about this is that if you can find something general enough, then you can wipe out an entire population. And the tricky part with cancer has been that a lot of tumors are fairly heterogeneous inside the cells.
Right.
So you go after them with some targeted drug, and it kills off all the ones that are susceptible,
right,
and leaves the ones behind that weren't, who now have a free field to play in, and they come back even faster and stronger.
Because they're using a different signaling pathway or something.
Exactly. They just you know, look around and see all those other cancer cells they were competing with dying off, and they high-five each other and get to work.
Right. It's basically, unfortunately, it's evolution in real time.
It is. It is right in front of you.
You know, another issue here, you know, I was at a briefing sponsored by the Friends of Cancer Research on Capitol Hill a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, and Janet Woodcock was there. She is the head of the FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, and she said that the industry she thought was on the a cusp of what she called a golden age of drug discovery, which is pretty bold given what we've just talking about in terms of number of failed targets and patent expirations.
Yeah.
It looks pretty bleak, but she was pretty optimistic. From what you're seeing at the ground level, is she right? Is there some reason for optimism that there's a sea change coming here?
I would really like to know on what basis she said that, because I'm hoping that we are turning a few corners in some areas, but in general, I don't know of anyone who's got the nerve inside the industry to say that we're entering a golden age of drug discovery. It's been grim the last few years. This is not news to anyone, but I have a tremendous number of colleagues who have been shaken out of the industry, displaced, laid off. Whole organizations have had tremendous rearrangements and downsizings. It's really quite rough. And the problem is that there are a lot of good ideas still out there, but we've been having a lot of good ideas over the past 10, 15, 20, 25 years. It's just a lot of them don't play out. This stuff is just a lot harder than it looks like. So anyone who pops up and says that we're entering a golden age of drug discovery, I worry that they're inviting divine retribution for saying something like that, because people have said that before and gotten a lightning bolt.
Right. Now, to be fair, I mean, she is sitting there and she's seeing the applications that are coming in. So she may be seeing trends that we're not seeing and says, well, you know, gee, the drugs that I'm seeing now are more innovative or more associated with biomarkers and targeted therapeutics. And I think that this is, you know, a real sea change from the applications I saw a few years ago. She might be seeing something we're not privy to, but I think you're right. I mean, I think recently the FDA announced that more drugs were released approved in the first half of 2011 than all of 2010, but 2010 was pretty low.
Right.
And, you know, the first 6 months of 2011 is just the first 6 months of 2011. It could just be a fluke.
Exactly. And, of course, these drugs that have been approved so far this year are drugs that were discovered back in the mid-1990s.
Right.
So it's not like there's something big that's been happening in the last two or three or four years that's changed things. That's one of the big problems that the whole drug industry has, is that our timelines are so long that if you have some great idea of how to do your research differently, you won't really know if it has an effect in the real world, you know, getting out to FDA approvals for 15 years.
I think the way you phrased it on your blog was, you know, you press down the pedal of your car and then 15 years later you see what happened.
Right, exactly. It's like having a car that you grab you only get to grab the steering wheel every few blocks, and then it's another half mile every time before the tires move. It's very difficult to get somewhere in a vehicle like that.
Right.
But at the same time, there's always this background hope. We keep accumulating knowledge. We keep learning about things that we didn't even realize existed. And there's this background hope that this is going to start adding up to something. That was the hope behind the whole genomics frenzy back around 2000. Oh my gosh, we're going to sequence the human genome and suddenly this gigantic bolus of knowledge is going to hit us and explode into drug targets. It didn't.
Right.
There have been a number of other things like that, but it's not like it didn't do anything. We've learned huge amounts. It's just that the problems themselves have turned out to be hugely more complex than we thought. So we still haven't gotten on top of that yet. Maybe eventually we will. In fact, you'd think we would have to. I just don't know when.
I think as you put it, I mean, in fact, what we're learning is how little we know in some of these cases.
Right, exactly. And that's a grim thing to go and tell your investors. You don't want to have to keep going back to them and say, hey, guys, you'll never believe it, but it turns out this is even wackier than we thought. You know, they get a little tired of hearing how hard everything is, but it's true.
Hope springs eternal. Although I think, you know, one thing that you're pointing out is the inputs into drug development or drug discovery have multiplied. We've got all these new omics sciences that are being utilized by companies. The price of whole genome sequencing has plummeted. I don't know where it's at now, but I think people think the magic number is $1,000. It may be at that right now. I haven't checked lately. But so the inputs are getting faster, smarter, cheaper, but the outputs are not following. Is a potential, I've heard some people express this concern, is we still learn a lot more in the clinic than we do at the lab table.
We do.
And one thing we have to find a way to do, perhaps this is a study's example of it, is get promising things into patients faster to see what happens. And I know that that's a dangerous approach in terms of sometimes things are going to go pretty badly wrong.
Right.
But at the same time, in patients like this that have just basically exhausted hope and you've got a novel approach, maybe that's the best way of getting, call it proof of concept, faster. Is that a paradigm that's worth exploring that we might
Absolutely.
Learn from?
Absolutely. In fact, I think you're seeing that. There's a fellow named Bernard Munoz, ex-Eli Lilly, consultant now. He's going around telling people, look, our chances in the clinic are slim. We all know that. So, and this is going to sound depressing at first, but what he's saying is, don't go after the diseases that will require you to enlist 10,000 patients for 8 years to prove something in the clinic, because your chances of failure are just as great as everywhere else.
Right.
It's kind of like the old advice to daughters saying, oh, it's easy to just as one. If you're going to go work on a drug discovery project, go work on one that you can get clinical evidence for more quickly and more cheaply.
Right.
Even if it's a smaller disease, at least you'll be able to find something, as opposed to spending $1 billion going down the tubes with yet another swing at Alzheimer's or something like that. Now, that's kind of depressing in a way, because it means, if Munoz is right, there are several therapeutic areas that we should honestly just abandon for a while until we know more about them. And, of course, the process of knowing more about, say, Alzheimer's has been taking decades, and the end is not in sight. But he may have a point there, because we cannot go on throwing billions of dollars at these gigantic clinical trials, which have a 90-something percent failure rate.
Right.
That's just not a sustainable model.
Right. So the aim would be to get things into clinic as quickly as possible. I think the idea that's been kicked around is sometime late in phase two, test them and just find out if you've got proof of efficacy there, and if not, kill the program.
And pick diseases and pick drug targets where that's possible, because
right.
there are some things where it's just not. The diseases themselves are too slow-moving, and the patient population is too heterogeneous.
Right.
That's one of the things about this CLL study. I mean, it's a very, very clearly defined disease.
Mm.
You can see the cells that are causing the problem.
Right.
And every patient has... You know, you can genotype these cells, and you can tell exactly who's like everyone else.
Right.
In a disease like Alzheimer's or schizophrenia or osteoporosis, you can't say that.
You might have three or four different underlying syndromes that are going on
right.
and that may vary across patients.
And it's a problem. And, of course, that's why all the money has been poured into biomarkers over the last 15 or 20 years. That hasn't borne fruit as quickly as we would have liked. But, again, it's something that eventually has to work. It's just turned out to mean a lot more time and money to make it work than we originally thought.
And one final thought, is it possible that by starting with these smaller niche populations, you're going to learn something that's going to benefit you in the larger populations as well?
It could well be. I mean, that's the great thing about biomedical research and science in general, is that you really don't know what you're going to find out and how widespread the applicability is going to be. So I think every time something actually goes into the clinic and works, it's valuable far beyond just that therapeutic area.
Right.
Now, every time something goes into the clinic and fails, we learn something too. But unfortunately, we just learn, well, by golly, that approach does not work.
Absolutely.
Successes have a little bit wider range of influence.
Absolutely. The case I had in mind there was something like Gleevec, which came online for CML, leukemia.
Right.
Only about, I guess, 6,000 or 7,000 patients in the U.S. every year, but now is used, I think, in 12 different cancers.
It is, yeah. And I think that some of those uses are probably more efficacious than others, but at the same time, it has been expanding people's ideas of what might work in any given cancer. And, of course, cancer is probably about 8,000 or 10,000 different diseases, so there is a lot of room to expand and a lot of room to learn stuff.
Terrific. Well, that's a great note to end on. Derek, thanks for the terrific conversation, and please come back on again and talk about your great blogging on In the Pipeline.
I would really enjoy it.
Thank you very much, Derek. Take care.